We're talking about layoffs in the trucking industry here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The American Trucking Associations recently released its annual transportation forecast that extends out to 2030. It projects strong growth over the next decade as the U.S. economy and population grow. But 2019, not so rosy. So far this year, more than 3,000 truck drivers have lost their jobs as trucking companies large and small go bankrupt. Are you a truck driver? What are you seeing in the industry that has you concerned? Do you feel like you have job security? Join in with your story, your questions about the industry, 800-642-1234. Rachel Premack is a transportation reporter at Business Insider. The site covers U.S. financial and business news. Rachel, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me.
So there's the word bloodbath that comes up repeatedly in your reporting on the trucking industry. If you can tell us, where is that coming from? What does that bloodbath look like?
So over the past few months, hundreds of truckers have reached out to me saying that their incomes have dropped in 2019 and that basically the industry this year is really challenging. We've seen quite a few trucking companies go under this year as well. And I think this really contrasts with 2018, where trucking was doing extremely well. There was a shortage of truckers. There was a shortage of capacity in the market. And now, because of that, so many companies, so many drivers entered trucking in 2018. But now the balance has shifted again, and there are too many trucks and not enough loads. So a lot of drivers are feeling the pain from that.
Okay, so why has the market shifted so rapidly over the course of a year?
It happens quite a bit in trucking where things are going really well, so then everyone is like, okay, let's buy a bunch of trucks, let's get into this industry, let's really invest into this, but everyone has the same idea at the same time. So these curves, these ups and downs are pretty common in trucking, but this is probably one of the most rapid shifts we've seen in quite a while.
What have you been hearing from truck drivers as they reach out to you? What are their fears and concerns?
They are definitely very concerned about their companies going under. They're concerned about their own loads not being as profitable as they used to be. So, you know, a trucker will tell me that one load that may have been a few thousand dollars to move is now down to a few hundred dollars to move. So there's some pretty quick downturns in how much money people are making. And then the other part of this is that we've also seen that fewer trucking companies can actually pay off their fuel cards for truckers, so they'll have to cover for gas on their truck, which is obviously quite a hefty expense for a truck driver, out of pocket, and they're not sure whether that company will pay them back or what exactly the situation with that might be.
Well, at the same time, the American Trucking Associations, their forecast looks really good over the next decade. So is this just a blip this year?
Well, the thing to keep in mind with the American Trucking Associations is that that's the coalition of America's largest trucking companies. So during these tough times, large trucking companies tend to suffer a bit, but aren't likely to go bankrupt as much as these fleets with maybe a few hundred, a few dozen, or just a few thousand trucks. But overall, with the rise of e-commerce and more people ordering things to their homes, and if the economy continues to grow, naturally trucking will continue to grow as well.
We're looking at the state of the trucking industry with Rachel Premack. She's a transportation reporter at Business Insider. You can join in. What questions do you have about the trucking industry right now? Are you a truck driver? How do you feel about the future of your work? We're at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Rachel, you've been keeping tabs of how many job losses there are going on across the country. Where are you seeing these numbers? Where are they at?
So right now we're seeing more than 3,000 have lost their jobs. And to keep in mind, there are almost 2 million truck drivers, long-haul truck drivers across the U.S. But this is the we compared to 2018, the amount of trucking companies that have I've gone out of business have actually tripled. I'm sorry, has more than doubled from 2018 to 2019. So that's definitely very concerning and sort of a definitely shows that companies are really suffering this year.
Is trucking the industry as a whole, could that have a ripple effect on the rest of the economy?
So a lot of economists look at trucking as sort of a leading indicator for where the rest of the economy is going. Because if people aren't ordering, if manufacturers aren't making enough, if retailers aren't needing more goods, if more homes aren't being built, and so on and so forth, naturally there will be fewer trucks. So if as we see trucking decline, we've also seen manufacturing decline. We've seen shaky retail numbers this year. So a lot of economists kind of look at trucking as a leading indicator for where the rest of the economy is going. And a new report shows that about half the time there is a recession in trucking, that foretells a recession in the larger economy. So it's not a perfect science, but it definitely, when we look at all these other sort of indicators for a recession, it does correlate quite a bit and is concerning quite a few people.
What impact might tariffs have on the trucking industry? Has the trade dispute with China had an impact in any way?
That's something that's up for debate. Some truckers who have noticed that their income has shrank this year, they're sort of blaming Trump. They're blaming the trade war. Analysts aren't so sure if that's a direct correlation. But if you look at certain markets, if you look at, Southern California, where most of the shipments from East Asia come in, there has been some changes in how high rates are and these sorts of things.
And there's also been talk of self-driving trucks that would disrupt this entire industry. Are they taking hold at all?
Not yet. There are maybe a couple dozen self-driving trucks on the road that are being tested right now, and almost all of those have at least a driver as well as an engineer in the seat. So right now, self-driving trucks aren't threatening drivers anytime soon, but probably in the next 5 or 10 years is when experts say that there's going to be some meaningful impacts in the trucking economy at large.
Well, you watch the wide sector of the transportation, with truck driving being one segment of the transportation and logistics marketplace. What else do you see on this front? Are there any other areas that you're seeing a downturn?
Right. Air freight has really struggled this year, which that's definitely a direct effect of tariffs. We've seen sort of shaky numbers from rail cargo. So some people say this been going really well. It's been going up. Other companies have said that their rates are way down, that there's way more issues, and they also are blaming tariffs and those sorts of things. But it is interesting because it's definitely impacting different companies in different ways. So UPS actually had their one of their best quarters last year. Meanwhile, FedEx has been really struggling during especially during these tariffs and these sorts of things. So it's hit or miss for different companies, so for some of these very large companies. But we've definitely seen that air cargo and rail cargo are being affected right now.
Rachel, thank you for joining us.
Yeah, thank you for having me on.
Rachel Premack is a transportation reporter at Business Insider. Coming up, the practice of mindfulness has grown in popularity in recent decades. We learn about what meditation can deliver on, what it may fall short on. Do you practice mindfulness? Why did you start? What benefits have you seen? Do you think it can reduce stress? Join in at 800-642-1234. We'll get to this in just a moment here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about mindfulness and stress-reducing mental exercises that focus your awareness on the present moment. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Researchers in the UK recently launched a study to test whether relaxation exercises can reduce stress and improve mental health of children in England. It's one of a raft of studies. Two new studies out of the Massachusetts Institute of Technology suggest that mindfulness can improve academic performance and mental health in middle schoolers. It's credited for fewer suspensions and less stress. But should it get all the credit? Do you practice mindfulness? Why did you start? What benefits have you seen? Did it fall short in any way? Did you try mindfulness and find it wasn't for you? Tell us what you think at 800-642-1234. Sahanika Ratnayake is a graduate student in philosophy at the University of Cambridge. She's been studying mindfulness and contemporary psychotherapy, and she wrote an essay on mindfulness recently in the digital magazine Eon. Sahanika, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Well, certainly mindfulness has become almost a buzzword in this decade for sure, and it's been around quite a while. How is it different from meditation? What is it?
So when you say meditation, it kind of, there's a vast variety of things that count as meditation. So there's a lot of meditation coming out of different faith traditions. So strangely enough, which most people are not familiar with, various sects of Christianity and Judaism actually have their own brand of meditation. So the real sort of achievement of modern mindfulness is that it gives you a meditation technique that's presented to you as being, you know, very secular, that doesn't have these kinds of historical roots. It's backed by science. It can do all sorts of cool things. And it's straightforward without kind of leading back into these historical trajectories, which I think is a little misleading. But yes, so insofar as it, the unique claim it makes is that mindfulness is about this non-judgmental awareness of the present moment. So you're just supposed to observe things that happen and not really engage with them in any way. You're just kind of watching them arise and pass in your mind.
Right, arising, you know, coming in and going out of your mind. So it's essentially just being right there in the moment?
That's usually how it's presented as.
Okay, so what are the desired effects of mindfulness? What are you trying to get out of it?
So the people who are proponents of mindfulness will tell you that over time, your stress levels will be reduced. As you said in the intro, it seems to have really good beneficial effects on mental health. So it's got this whole package of claims, usually around the reduction of stress and anxiety, that for what it's worth, I think I'm not surprised at all that it does those things. I've personally found it beneficial on those fronts.
Well, package of claims, can we unwrap that package a little bit? Because certainly there have been a number of claims, including reducing stress and anxiety. Can we make those bold claims?
It's interesting because I think as you say, the study after study seems to have shown that it actually does have very good effects on stress and anxiety. What's been really interesting is that over the years, the number of claims seem to have gone up. So now if you just do kind of a quick Google for mindfulness, you'll find people claiming that it helps them with all kinds of things, like it boosts their creativity, they understand themselves better. And I think there's been a couple of books about parenting mindfully, which I find really fascinating. It seems to have spread outwards into a number of different areas.
And you have your own experience with mindfulness. Did you find that the practice helped you?
It's an interesting question because I think it definitely did for the longest time, but it helped when I was engaging with it kind of sporadically. So I first encountered mindfulness as an undergraduate. I'd gone to the university in counseling service because I was extremely stressed. I think a lot of students kind of experience this. You go to university for the first time, you find it really stressful, you find it hard to adjust. So you go to counseling, and I got taught these mindfulness techniques, so usually breathing exercises and things. And I used to do these occasionally, usually when I was preparing for exams or when I had to write something and I was super stressed. So insofar as I was using it kind of sporadically, it seemed to work. I would calm down. I would, you know, be able to do the thing I was trying to do. I think it became sort of trickier when I took part in this mindfulness study that happened at the University of Cambridge. So from there, I switched from doing mindfulness occasionally to keeping up a regular practice. So this was this period where, you know, quite a lot of my friends were taking part in this. Everybody seemed to be meditating at odd hours and things. And so you were kind of encouraged to keep up a regular mindfulness practice. So you would do this every day. And it was around this time that I really had some really odd reactions to the practice. I found myself just struggling to, it's quite hard to articulate, but I found myself struggling to understand myself, and especially why I was thinking and feeling the way I was thinking and feeling.
We're talking with Sahanaka Ratnayaka. She's a graduate student in philosophy at the University of Cambridge. We're taking a closer look at mindfulness. She studies it as well as contemporary psychotherapy. You can join in. Do you have a mindfulness practice? How does it go? How did you get started? Join in with your story at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Sahanaka, you felt some negative effects of mindfulness in your experience, things that you didn't realize might be the result of this practice. What did you find?
I found mostly that I was really just struggling to make sense of myself. So I would find myself thinking, okay, I'm super stressed right now. Why am I stressed? And I couldn't quite pin down the cause of these feelings. So I would go, is it because I'm not enjoying the course? Is it because I have, you know, I'm really insecure about being here? So I would find it really hard to go, okay, I'm thinking this thing or I'm feeling this thing. Why is this happening? I just couldn't, you know, that kind of connection between going, I feel this. Why do I feel this? I was really struggling to make those connections.
And you left a doctoral program entirely to look at a different area of philosophy and reapply just so that you could understand what it had been happening to you.
Yes, it seems like a crazy thing to have done now. So the doctoral program I left was in Buddhist philosophy, was on Buddhist metaphysics. And the entire time I was there, I was sort of secretly reading books on mindfulness and, you know, looking at the citations and trying to figure out what was going on. And what kind of came out of this, you know, weird obsession with reading mindfulness books and tracing citations was that a lot of mindfulness, in spite of this claim that they have about the practice just being entirely secular, not really being connected to anything else, it traces all the way back to early Buddhist ideas and early Buddhist meditation practices.
What are some of those Buddhist ideas and meditation practices that you find really are the underpinning of mindfulness practices today in modern mindfulness?
So one of the really sort of fascinating ideas that comes out of Buddhism is the idea that there's no self. So in the West, we tend to think of, you know, ourselves as there's something there sitting behind our thoughts and feelings. There's someone that thinks these thoughts. There's something that has these feelings. So in Buddhism, what you get is the idea that there's thoughts and feelings, but there's not actually anyone that these thoughts and feelings belong to. And a lot of their, you know, theories and philosophies and actually their meditation practices are set up to make this case in various ways. So they'll get you to watch your experiences and note that, okay, there's thoughts and feelings, they come and go, but actually there's no one doing the thinking and feeling. And modern mindfulness practices, interestingly, draw attention to the same features of experience that Buddhist mindfulness practices do. They ask you to think about how your thoughts and feelings come and go. They ask you to think about how you can't control them. These are basically the same arguments you find in early Buddhism for why there's no self.
So how does this type of mindset help people who believe it distances themselves from anxiety or stress?
I think one of the really fruitful things about thinking in this way is that you don't get sort of obsessed with your thoughts and feelings. You don't kind of keep repeating to yourself that you're stressed or, oh no, I'm having a hard time, I'm having a hard time. If you can just sort of step back from it and go, okay, like I'm stressed now, but the stress will come and go, or like I'm having a hard time, but that will come and go. I don't have to kind of overly identify with these things. I can see why that would help. It certainly helped me to go, right, I'm going to take a step back from the thing. I think the issue is that over time, you kind of lose this framework of thinking, okay, but these are my thoughts and feelings. What am I supposed to do about them?
Like there's something missing.
Yeah, that kind of really, you know, the obvious connection that you feel to your thoughts and feelings, that they're not just popping up in your head out of nowhere. They're your thoughts and feelings. They mean something. They reflect something about you or the environment. So that connection is missing.
We're talking about mindfulness and the spiritual practices, the self-care. It's popping up all around us. Sahanika Ratnayake is a doctoral student in philosophy at the University of Cambridge. She's studying mindfulness. Do you teach mindfulness? What do you think people should bear in mind about it? Does your school or work promote mindfulness exercises? Are you on board? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Coming up, we'll take a closer look at whether mindfulness can actually help solve modern problems. That's right after this news update. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about mindfulness, what it does for us, and why it's become so popular in recent decades. You're with us on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Mindfulness is all about being aware, being fully present in the moment, paying attention to your thoughts and feelings and movements that are coming into your senses. I was on planes last week, and the screens in the plane were all set to the Calm channel. At one point before takeoff, it instructed us to do nothing for 30 seconds. As a second hand swept smoothly across the screen. And in those moments, I looked around to see if anyone looked more tranquil in economy class, and I couldn't tell, frankly. What are your thoughts on mindfulness being used to reduce stress and anxiety? Do you take issue with it being presented as a cure-all? Have you been encouraged to practice mindfulness by a physician or a spiritual leader? We're at 800-642-1234 to join in. Sahanika Ratnayake is a doctoral student in philosophy at the University of Cambridge, where she studies mindfulness, and she stays with us. One practice of mindfulness includes focusing on the experience of eating a raisin. Sahanika, what do we know about this raisin thing?
I've been baffled by the raisin thing. I somehow managed to miss out on it, but apparently it's one of the most popular sort of introductory exercises. So my friends who've actually done it say you're just sitting there in this mindfulness class and all of you are just slowly eating this raisin, which sounds to be quite hilarious. But I think the thought is something like, most of the time when we eat things, especially tiny things like raisins, you just don't really think about it. So when you do, when you're actually mindfully engaging with this experience, you get to notice all the stuff that you normally don't. Just, you know, how the textures change. And how raisins smell, I suppose. So it's very odd, but I can see how it's just trying to get you to re-engage with something that normally you wouldn't even bother to pay attention to.
Oh, it's kind of like this gateway into mindfulness.
Absolutely. It's one of the more popular introductory exercises I've heard.
Well, mindfulness is a suggested cure for a lot of different health problems. Has mindfulness become kind of a cure-all?
It definitely seems like it's increasingly being sold that way. And I think this is just kind of a common thing that happens with this sort of stuff. You start off with it being actually proven to help with a small number of things. And then in order to kind of sell it, the claims become more and more grandiose. And especially because there's this huge problem with background levels of stress and how we live anyway, you can see how the claims get overblown to the point where it just sounds like, it's capable of doing anything and everything.
Right. And certainly it becomes then indoctrinated in other, many different parts of society, from corporate America into school settings.
Yes. And it makes a certain amount of sense, because these are places naturally with a certain level of stress associated with being there. But I have to admit, it's one of the things, maybe this is a bit like bolshy of me or something, but I do find it quite strange how it's become integrated into workplaces. Because I personally would be a bit suspicious if my employer was like, well, you're very stressed, but let's do a mindfulness course, as opposed to trying to engage with why the employees are very stressed in the first place. It seems to me like a very strange band-aid solution.
Corey emailed us and said mindfulness is part of his Buddhist practice. He said, I've tried cognitive behavioral therapy, acceptance and commitment therapy, and mindfulness to treat PTSD. All three have elements of Buddhism, but are incomplete on their own. So it sounds like Corey is looking at a combination of things.
I'm not surprised. Increasingly, when you go to therapy these days, your therapist will just kind of offer you a bunch of options and they'll try any number of things. And a lot of people I know who've had therapy for quite a long time have just moved between these various schools. So I'm not surprised. And it's, yes, and a lot of one of the things I'm fascinated by is that quite a lot of contemporary therapies have roots going back to Buddhism as well, even though they're not entirely transparent about it.
What do you think about mindfulness as a prescription or as part of a prescription for addressing mental health challenges?
I think it's not necessarily a terrible thing, provided it's seen as a tool. So as I said, I can see how it helps to deal with stress and anxiety and so on. I can see that it would be a valuable tool. The problem is that because it's being sold to you as part of this broader wellness culture, and, you know, the claims about its efficacy are growing larger and larger, there's a real danger, I think, of overlooking deep structural problems, of asking hard questions like, why are so many people stressed and anxious? Why is mental illness rising in the first place?
We're talking with Sahanika Ratnayake, who is a graduate student in philosophy at the University of Cambridge. We're looking at mindfulness. Have you been encouraged to practice mindfulness by your physician or spiritual leader? Do your kids come in contact with mindfulness techniques in school or extracurricular activities? Join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. Let's bring in Mike now, joining us from Wausau. Hi, Mike.
Good morning. How are you doing today?
Good. What are your thoughts on mindfulness?
Well, I really appreciate it. And I started off seeking truth. That's really what I was looking for, and found my way into Buddhism. Studied Buddhism for several years, and then I just wasn't finding what I was looking for. I couldn't find that truth that the Buddha had talked about. So I started reading a book that my mother gave me called Living Buddha, Living Christ, and I found my way into Christianity, which I still meditate, and I still practice mindfulness. And I kind of wanted to make a funny comment about how at work sometimes I say I'm underwater because I dive. I'm a commercial diver.
Oh.
And the guys just think I'm a weirdo because I'll be underwater and I'll be like, hey guys, I'm underwater. And I'm just practicing, you know, being where I'm at, like right at that moment. And I like to try to do that during the day and just practice that mindfulness. It's calming. I feel like I'm more connected and, you know, don't react as quickly to things. Like as far as stressfulness, I can stop for a minute and take account of what's going on a little bit better.
Yeah. Do you feel like there's a, since you've practiced mindfulness, do you feel like there's an old mic and a new mic in certain respects?
Oh, I definitely believe that there is an old mic and a new mic. Sometimes I'll fall back to the old mic, though, very often, and try to find my way back to the newer mic or a better mic.
So, Hanukkah, what do you hear from Mike's perspective on mindfulness?
It's not surprising to me at all. I think a lot of people get a lot out of mindfulness. The thing I found really interesting was that, you know, you had to kind of move away from just doing mindfulness and do some reading and stuff. And I think that's one of the things that I feel like sometimes is missing with our, you know, broader culture around this stuff, where we get kind of told, just do the practice and it'll be fine. And one of the lovely things about the story was, you know, you read this book and it really made you think about, like, yeah, what you thought of as truth. And I think that kind of, we're really missing that kind of deliberation with the way mindfulness is increasingly being sold.
Yeah, Mike sounds like he needed greater context to mm-hmm. what he was doing in order to do the mindfulness.
Absolutely.
You know, it's also being presented as value neutral, that the practice is not meant to conflict with people's worldview or spirituality or religion. Can you help us understand that value neutral aspect?
I think this very much has to do with how it was initially presented, which was, you know, it's sort of a meditation practice. It's mostly about these breathing exercises or these you know, eating raisins, that kind of a small cluster of exercises that had nothing to do with any particular religious context. So anyone could do them. If you were a Christian, you could just do them and not worry about whether you were doing a weird Buddhist thing. And it makes a certain amount of sense that it was sold this way. It was sold as a treatment for extreme stress initially, as part of a, you know, medical school program. So because science is so wary of getting involved with various religious things, it was presented as this kind of secular, value-neutral exercise that anyone could participate in without any problems.
Let's bring in Laura now, joining us from Kenosha. Hi, Laura.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Sure.
Yeah, I just really called with a pretty general comment. I teach yoga and meditation, which is similar to mindfulness, but like you were saying, not particularly the same thing. And really what I had wanted to say was I found it helpful, sort of like Mike was saying, in conjunction with other aspects of health. So, you know, eating well, being conscious of how you're interacting with other people, perhaps women's circles or therapy was how I happened to find meditation. But I loved what you were saying. You know, anyone can really meditate if they can breathe. Anyone can be mindful. And the one thing I kind of wanted to talk about was how there's some resistance because some people don't think it really goes hand in hand with religious spirituality, but I totally agree. You can mix and match and do it all. It can all work together.
Laura, thank you so much for those comments. It sounds like it's a tool in the toolbox, Sahanika, that as Laura said, you can mix and match.
Mm-hmm. I think you can definitely mix and match, and I think we need to move away from seeing, you know, any particular tool as being able to provide all the answers. So I do think it's important for us to remember where our tools come from. Like partially it's just kind of a, you know, matter of respect and cultural memory, but also when you start thinking, okay, like why is this maybe having unexpected effects in certain people? It would be good to know why and have some context for that.
How does yoga be a companion to mindfulness? How do those go hand in hand?
I know a lot of people seem to do both, and I've gone to a few yoga classes. I'm shamefully bad at it, but I get the impression increasingly yoga is being taught with a mindful focus as well. So it's not enough to just do the poses. You kind of want to be aware of what you're doing and what your body is doing. And it's that same engagement with the present moment, I think.
We're talking about the practice of mindfulness and the claims that it can reduce stress levels and build resilience. Sahanika Ratnayaka studies it as a doctoral student in philosophy at the University of Cambridge. Do you practice mindfulness? Why did you start? What benefits have you seen? Still time for you at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas@wpr.org. We'll get back to this conversation in just a minute. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. We're talking about mindfulness, what to make of it. Here in the morning show, I'm Kate Archer-Kent. With the steady alerts on our phone and the endless social media scroll, it seems that the attention economy makes time feel so urgent, so pressing. We're exploring mindfulness, focusing on the right now and what it's really tapping into and whether it helps people find better outcomes in life. As you listen, what comes up in this conversation for you? Do you practice or teach mindfulness? We're at 800-642-1234. Sahanika Ratnayaka is a philosophy doctoral student at the University of Cambridge, and she stays with us. Let's bring in a call now. Sherry joining us from Madison. Hi, Sherry.
Hi. Good morning. You know, as you were talking about this, I was thinking back to when I was a kid in the summer, and I remember telling my dad one day, I'm really bored. I wanted something to do. And he said, well, just take time to think. He said, thinking is good. And it made me recognize that thinking is something to do, that it is something we can actually focus on. And so So he was actually quite a genius, and he did a lot of thinking and came up with a lot of good things. So that's been very useful to me over the years.
And it sounds like you've really kept that philosophy with you through the years.
Yes. And also now over these last, maybe 15, 20 years, I've had a lot of health issues and a lot of pain. And with that has come some anxiety and depression. And I have found that it really helps to get my mind on something else. In other words, to change the stream of thought. And I think, you know, that's what they're attempting to do with mindfulness, is just to change your stream of thought. And for me, a lot of times it's like getting into a TV program or a movie that's a story, so that my mind is really off of my own life and my own situation.
So your mind can rest. Yeah. Sherry, thanks so much. Zahanaka, what do you make of Sherry's story and allowing her mind to rest by thinking?
I think it's an interesting kind of characterization of mindfulness, because one of the interesting things about mindfulness is that they don't kind of want you to engage with the process of normal thinking. They want you to kind of watch your thoughts. And I think, as Sherry points out, once you sort of detach from your thoughts in that way, you often do find that they kind of change subject. But I think one of the great pleasures of thinking is just, you know, you're engaged with your thoughts, you think something through. I know maybe this is like an occupational hazard because I'm a philosopher, but I spend quite a lot of time doing thinking. And it's the sort of thinking where you are properly engaged with your thoughts. You poke them around, you obsess over them, instead of just watching them pass by. I think one of the things I'd really like to see is this kind of acknowledgement that there's different kinds of engagement with your thoughts. Some of it is that kind of mindfulness thing where you watch them pass by, and the other one's the one where you like deeply engage with the process of thinking.
So what would you advise people who want to start a mindfulness practice?
I think I definitely don't think it's something they should avoid or anything. It certainly seems to have benefits. I think what they should see it as is a small part of living well, that there is, again, like some idea of a tool in a broader toolkit. There's different ways in which you can be healthy. There's different ways in which you can and should be thinking. It's just one of many things that you need to live a good life. So I think probably I would say don't buy into all the hype.
You found mindfulness to have those negative effects for you as an individual. Have you landed in your mindfulness journey? Where are you at?
I barely do mindfulness now. I'll do it occasionally, especially when I'm trying to sleep. Because I'll often sort of work, you know, into the evening, so I need something to sort of disengage from my work. So it really helps me then to shut off my brain and then go to sleep. But this thing where you do mindfulness every day and you build up a regular practice, I've definitely stepped away from that in a big way.
Well, Zahanaka, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Zahanaka Ratnayake is a graduate student in philosophy at the University of Cambridge, where she's been studying mindfulness and contemporary psychotherapy. When tech manufacturing giant Foxconn announced it would build a plant in Wisconsin 2 years ago, officials promised it would remake the village of Mount Pleasant. But Corrine Hess reports former property owners near the construction site say they were misled in pursuit of that vision, and now their homes are gone.
Every day in the state of Wisconsin, where properties are taken...
That's Alan Markovitz. He's an attorney for the Village of Mount Pleasant, arguing with residents in September 2018 over the number of properties being acquired for Foxconn. It was just one of many contentious board meetings since the Taiwanese manufacturer announced it would make LCD screens in the village. Kathy Jensen and her husband were at that September meeting. Their property and about a dozen others were acquired that night. Jensen says she started receiving letters from the village in fall of 2017, but ignored them.
Their initial paperwork said that they needed 0.13 acres of our frontage for a road project, but they would be generous and offer us basically twice the amount and buy our whole property, our whole 3 acres.
The Jensens later received a letter saying the village owned their property. They've since filed lawsuits in federal and county court. And that road project, it's done. None of the Jensens' property was affected, and there's no more road work planned for the area.
Mount Pleasant promised to purchase all of this land to convey to Foxconn, and Foxconn is not eminent domain.
Wisconsin municipalities can use eminent domain if there's fair compensation and the property will be used for a public purpose. But records obtained by Wisconsin Public Radio show in some cases, the village used road widening and other infrastructure plans to invoke eminent domain even though those projects changed or were dropped before properties were sold. Sean and Sarah Mayer moved into their custom-built dream home on Wheaton Lane in May 2017. Rumors about a Foxconn announcement started about a month later.
I had just had 36 pallets of paving bricks delivered. We had put in 30-foot trees, and we never did the grass on the backyard. I never even leveled off the sand in the kids' sandbox.
That fall, the mayors received a certified letter saying properties on Wheaton Lane had been rezoned to industrial.
It was going to be purchased or taken from with eminent domain.
All of the homes on Wheaton Lane have been bulldozed. Emails obtained by WPR show village officials told the State Department of Transportation the road would be removed for Foxconn, but the road remains intact. Claude Lois, project director for the village, acknowledged the plan to remove it could change. As of late July, a Wisconsin Watch analysis found the village had paid $160 million for 132 properties to make way for Foxconn-related development. Village officials declined to be interviewed, but sent a statement saying the vast majority of the acquisitions were voluntary. Eminent domain attorney Daniel Bach says he's never seen this much land acquired for a single project.
I've spoken to a lot of people who are eminent domain experts on this, and I've not found one that has found a sort of a parallel circumstance anywhere.
Analyst Alberto Moel wrote a Foxconn investor guide. He says Mount Pleasant has purchased nearly 3,000 acres for a company that doesn't always keep its promises, pointing to factories in Indonesia and Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, that both fizzled.
You know, the company was just doing what it always did, and somebody took them at their word. They're like, we're just talking big game.
Here in Mount Pleasant, the company's plans for manufacturing at the site have taken a sharp turn. Rather than making massive flat screens, the plant will make smaller screens. And a recent report requested by the state suggests the $10 billion plant may be closer to $2 billion. Next year, County Highway KR will be expanded to accommodate Foxconn's future workforce. Racine County will have to purchase nearly 70 acres. That includes 14 farms and 5 homes. Corrine Hess, Wisconsin Public Radio.
And the story was produced in partnership with Wisconsin Watch. Just ahead, dozens of family farms in Wisconsin filed for bankruptcy in the past year. We take a closer look at the issues farmers are facing and why our state leads the nation in the number of bankruptcy filings. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.